Hi, this is Stephanie Stillwell. I'm the facilitator for the Southern Kenai Peninsula Opioid Task Force. This community presentation was captured on April 22nd. It was hosted by the Opioid Task Force in conjunction with a number of local treatment and behavioral health agencies. The intention of this presentation was to help bring awareness to current options for treatment services in our community and to let folks know that help is here. You can learn more about the SKP Opioid Task Force on our Facebook page, as well as accessing a full list of resources for treatment services online at www.allthingsaddiction.net.
And our first presenter is Dr. Sarah Spencer, who is an addiction medicine specialist with the Nilchik Traditional Council Clinic.
So addiction is a treatable chronic medical disease, and it involves interactions between the brain and genetics and the environment and an individual's life experiences. And people with addiction use substances or engage in behaviors that become compulsive, and they continue to do them despite the harmful consequences that they're causing. And the good news is that prevention efforts and treatment approaches for addiction are generally as successful as those for other chronic diseases. In the United States, about 1 in 10 Americans has substance use disorder, and most common is alcohol. About half of those are people who are struggling with alcohol use disorder. And every year in the United States, about 95,000 people die from issues related to excessive alcohol use. Running close behind that now, unfortunately, is we had last year our highest number ever of drug overdose deaths. 83,000, which was a 20% increase from the year before. And it remains for a number of years now, the number one cause of death for people under age 50. And to put that in context of how many people that is. So if you take everyone under age 50 who died from COVID and add to that everyone who died from car accidents, gun homicides, and HIV/AIDS combined, this is still more people. And the United States has the highest drug-related mortality in the world. Alaska Native populations are disproportionately affected, certainly by alcohol-related mortality. Also, American Indians and Native Alaskans have the highest rate of methamphetamine-related mortality, so some of the more vulnerable populations disproportionately affected. Unfortunately, although there is treatment available, it's not available to everyone, or there are barriers to that, and only about 1 in 5 to 1 in 10 people who need treatment for their substance use disorder are able to get that treatment. And stigma is one of the biggest barriers to treatment. So the kind of shame that goes along with having the disease of addiction. And people who experience stigma are less likely to seek treatment. They don't want to admit that they have this problem, or they may have been actually treated poorly by someone in the medical field or in the behavioral health field before, making them even less likely to want to seek help, which of course just makes everything worse. And language is important to reduce stigma. The words we use really matter, and they have a big effect on the way we think in our heads and the way other people think. So instead of using terms like drug abuser or addict, we use person first language. So a person with an opioid use disorder, a person with an alcohol use disorder, rather than saying someone has, you know, a habit or a problem, they have a disease or a drug addiction. We don't use the words clean and dirty. You know, a person is not clean when they're sober. They're a person that's in remission or in recovery. And it's really important to recognize the fact that one of the biggest risk factors for developing addiction is childhood trauma or adverse childhood events. And in a lot of ways is the real gateway drug. So if we look at people who have 6 or more adverse childhood events, they are 46 times more likely to use IV drugs. So pretty dramatic effect. And this doctor, I love the way he says it. You know, he says that addiction should be called ritualized compulsive comfort seeking, and that ritualized compulsive comfort seeking is a normal response to the adversity experienced in childhood, just like bleeding is a normal response to being stabbed. So the factors that put someone at risk and lead to addiction are many and mixed, and a lot of it are things out of the person's control. So again, those adverse childhood effects or the environment that they're living or raised in, they may not have control over. Their biology and their genetics. So about half of your likelihood of being at risk for addiction is your, you know, if you have a first degree relative, like a parent or a brother or sister that is dealing with addiction. And then the person get exposed to drugs, and that may be sometimes through recreational drug use, you know, their normal sort of what you think of teenage experimental drug use, what it may actually be prescribed drug use from a doctor. And that person, you know, if you don't have a brain that's primed to be vulnerable to addiction, you can take that drug, experiment with it, put it down, no problem. But a person who has a vulnerable brain that's primed to be susceptible to addiction, their brain can latch onto that, and they can very quickly develop addiction and the chronic brain changes that go along with addiction, and it becomes out of their control. And when we diagnose someone with a substance use disorder, there's kind of three main categories that we look at. So one is the physical part, the tolerance or the withdrawal that you might get if you become physically dependent on a drug. The second would be the loss of control. You use more than you mean to, you try to cut down, but you're not able to, and you give up other things in your life because you pursue the drug use. And then the consequences, you can't stop despite the bad consequences. Like, it's affecting your work, it's affecting your relationships, you lost your job, you got a DUI, you're having medical problems, but you still can't stop. Drugs that are addictive hijack the pleasure centers of your brain. And there's lots of different receptors that drugs work on. The dopamine receptors are a common one, especially with stimulants. You know, normally parts of our brain are important when they're supposed to give pleasure when we're doing something that we need to survive, when we eat, when we love and take care of our children, having sex, all these things bring us pleasure. So we pursue them for survival. But the drugs cause these neurotransmitters to just be dumped in a really abnormal way that causes this intense euphoria that then leads to the risk of addiction. For dopamine, methamphetamine is the biggest example of this. If you look at like food, this causes this little bump in dopamine. Alcohol and nicotine, a little bit bigger bump in dopamine. Cocaine, a little bigger. But meth is just off the charts. It just dumps every ounce of dopamine left in your brain, and you have nothing left. And you can't feel normal or pleasure, have any energy again unless you use the drug again. And different drugs affect the brain in different ways, but they all affect the chemistry of the brain and the wiring in the brain, and they cause changes in brain metabolism. And for all sorts of different drugs, we see similar changes in parts of the brain, just like we could see changes in like a diseased heart. One of the misconceptions about, you know, drug use is that people are always using drugs because they just want to get high. So when you first start using drugs, yes, when you use the drug, you feel pleasure, you feel high. And that's what we call positive reinforcement. And that's a drive to want to use the drug. But as you start to develop significant dependence and tolerance on that, you can use the drug or the alcohol or whatever, and you don't get the same level of intoxication. But what happens is if you don't use the substance, you go through withdrawal, you feel horrible. And so you get this negative reinforcement or negative drive. You're using not to experience pleasure, you're using to relieve the pain of withdrawal and the absence of the drug. In the cycle of addiction, there's something that triggers someone, a usually stressful event, or maybe seeing or a person, place, or thing that they used to use with it triggers a craving, and then they engage in the ritual and use, and then they feel incredibly guilty afterwards. And then that guilt feeds into the stressful emotional trigger to continue this. Every time you engage in this cycle, it just further and further strengthens those addiction pathways within the brain. And when people don't get any treatment for addiction, most people are going to go back to using. So addiction, you know, just trying to say, you know, you can do it by yourself. It's a matter of willpower. If you just want to badly enough, you know, it's not how addiction works. People need help either with medications and or behavioral health, psychosocial support. Otherwise, you know, most people are, you know, going to go back to using again if they don't get help. And there are certain addictions like alcohol, nicotine, and opioids. There are medications that can help. Opioids particularly have the most powerful medications that help. So if people take one of the medications, abstinence, again, 95% of people are going to go back to using. But if they take one of these medications like naltrexone, buprenorphine, or methadone, they're going to have about a 10 times more likely chance of being able to stay away from that drug and being able to remain in treatment. So some of the drugs, the medications that can help people can be very powerful tools. And the medications for opioid use disorder actually dramatically reduce death rates. So we see, you know, those tens of thousands of people dying every year. It's one of the most powerful tools we have to fight mortality related to opioid use disorder is by medications for addiction treatment to reduce those by up to 80%. But those medications only work when you're taking them. And when people go off their medications, their risk of overdose just skyrockets up to 10 to 30 times higher. So it's very important that we keep people on their medications. Now, what's important to remember too is that the brain can heal. It takes time, but we see here we see a lot of brain changes with methamphetamine use because methamphetamine in particular, alcohol as well, is very neurotoxic. It really actually damages the nerves in the brain. And so so we see, you know, this loss of, here again, this is the dopamine transporters, losing that. But if they can remain abstinent, this is a person 2 years out of abstinence, we start to see that function coming back in the brain. So the brain can heal, you know, with enough time, with enough support to get the person to that point to allow that to happen. What's important as a community is that we all work together to make sure that when someone is ready for treatment, that we can help them get there, no matter whether they're presenting to their counselor at the counseling center, to their doctor in the clinic, in the emergency room, in the jail, you know, at the syringe access program, no matter where they come and they're looking for help, we should all be able to know, you know, how we can get them the help that they need and get them that help right away when they're ready. And it's important that we have a patient-centered philosophy when we talk about substance use disorder treatment, that you know, we are there to help the patients meet their goals, not to tell them what to do. So we meet the patients where they're at, and then we try not to leave them there, but, you know, give them the helping hand and support to meet their goals and get where they want to be. And so the guiding principles of that, we treat all patients with respect and dignity, regardless of the disease severity, and work with patients to set their own goals for their care, offer a broad level of range of support to meet the patient needs, and acknowledge that patients have the right to determine their level of care and participation. And we never discharge a patient from treatment because are having active disease and have returned to use.
Thank you, Dr. Spencer. The next, we have our folks at Set Free Alaska. Philip and Jason, I'm going to mute and hand it over to you.
Set Free Alaska has services in Mat-Su as well as Homer. And there's just one program I want to bring you up to speed on in Mat-Su. I'll give you an update on what's going on in Homer. So we have an outpatient. For those of you who aren't too familiar with ASAM, it would be considered kind of a low intensity outpatient up to high intensity outpatient. And that program is co-ed. We're doing primarily telehealth right now, but also doing some individual appointments as well now in person. And so our office is right there on Ocean Drive, and we do assessments for individuals who need to get into treatment. And that could be if they even needed to get into treatment, say they wanted to go Serenity House or somewhere into another program that is out of the area or not one of our programs. We could get them a substance abuse assessment, do a diagnosis, and help get them into the greater level of care that they need, you know, wherever that might be. So that program is located right off Ocean Drive and right across from the farmers market, if you're familiar with that area. Our men's residential program, which is the ASAM 3.5, it's considered high intensity. And this is the first program of its kind in Alaska where men could bring their children to come stay at the program with them. So we have capacity for 16 at our men's home, and we do have beds available right now. Access point for either of those services is to contact our organization. We're so excited to be actually providing service in Homer after a long journey of getting to this point. Thankful for all the partnerships for those on the call and many others. It's been quite a journey, and we're thankful to be there fighting alongside with all of you.
And next we have Homer Medical. So I am going to hand it over to Bonita.
Yeah, I'm a nurse at Homer Medical, which is part of South Peninsula Hospital. Worked there for about 6.5 years. And prior to setting up this MAT program, I did community education. So I've been involved with the opioid task force more in prevention piece of it. So I'm fairly new getting into the treatment side of it. I had done work on our community health needs assessments over the past couple, and the hospital, being a community nonprofit hospital, does a community health needs assessment, as most of you are aware, every 3 years. One of the most talked about negatively impacting our community was the lack of drug and alcohol treatment for our community. So spring of 2020, some folks at Homer Medical started the process working with the Opioid Response Network. And they got a lot of sort of the groundwork started on having a program that would treat substance use disorder in a service area. And so of course that includes opioid use disorder, alcohol use disorder as well, primarily moderate to severe levels. We had several providers who were interested in going through the training, the DATA 2000 waiver training, so that they could prescribe Suboxone. And we currently have 6 providers at Homer Medical who are waivered. We also have one at the West Wing, which is our nurse midwives, and one at the family care clinic. So these are the ones who are not only waivered, but are interested in prescribing. We have 3 prescribers who have become waivered, and they will step in an emergency if one of these providers I'm working with is not available on a specific day. They have been known to step in and they'll write a script if needed. But primarily Dr. Bell, Lisa Milam, who's a DNP, and Matt Swain, who recently joined us from the VA, are all working out of Homer Medical. Really super personable, have a great way with the patients that they see, no matter what they're seeing them for. And I feel very fortunate that it's these 3 that I get to work with primarily. And then recently I've gotten the opportunity to work a lot more with Dana Whitaker, who's a nurse midwife and adult NP provider at the West Wing, with some of our clients who are also pregnant and also have a substance use disorder. We'll see Dana, and I'm able to just cross the street and see them at the same time that they're showing up for their OB appointments. So we're trying to really remove as many barriers as possible, so we're not making them go one place for their OB appointment and then come over to Homer Medical for their MAT appointment. And then Carol Clamser is also waivered, and she has a number of chronic pain management patients that she is working with ultimately, and in the hopes of weaning them off a lot of their chronic pain management medications and transitioning them into, for those who are appropriate, buprenorphine of some sort. So just a little overview of how we set it up at Homer Medical. We use the nurse care manager model, which is what the Boston Medical Center has written about and developed, and it has actually become the gold standard for MAT. And what that means is that when someone comes in for MAT treatment, they meet with me, they do an intake with me. I'm the one that they will see every time that they come, whatever it is that they need. And we do this in a little more personable setting. It's not an exam room. If necessary, we move into an exam room for the final, 10, 15 minutes with a provider. So we had our first MAT client last October, and we have had at least 1 or 2 patients, new people come, whether they've stayed with us or they were passing through, but have worked with us every month since then. So it's been a fairly steady intake. And then, as we all know, behavioral health involvement is one of the keystones of being successful in addiction treatment programs. And unfortunately, at the hospital, we're not able to just have that access. So we work with people in the community, with the center, with Cicada, with individuals, with the 12-step programs, the non-12-step programs, and try and engage people in that aspect of their recovery.
Thank you for all of the presentation there, Bonita. Next, we have Cook Inlet Counseling.
My name is Charlie Simons. I'm the executive director with Cook Inlet Counseling, formerly really known as Cook Inlet Counseling on Alcohol and Drug Abuse. That is a very specific name. It's very narrow in its focus. It's not really who we are or what we do. So as I presented the board with this idea that maybe we should shift that a little bit, to be a little more inclusive, they were certainly on board. Mission statement changed along with that. Our mission now is to help people empower, heal, and connect with people, family, and community. We know that abstinence is a part of people's recovery, but I love the statement that the opposite of addiction is not abstinence, it is connection. We strive to provide understanding and supportive environment for healing from trauma and substance use. through building internal wellness and connection. We work with both adults and with youth. First step, of course, for people, I thought it would be prudent in this this opportunity to really describe the steps kind of that people take to get into services. And assessments are always that first step for people to see where the right fit is. We provide individual assessment sessions to help people identify substance use or mental health experiences that will benefit from therapeutic support. And that is the first step in the process once a person starts seeking care. Recommended therapeutic care is based on the assessment. It can occur individually. We do telehealth or in-person, therapeutic group or both, covering outpatient and intensive outpatient levels of care. We are really looking to just find whatever the best fit is for that person. And we'll work with that person to find whatever that best fit is, whether it's a residential placement, a different outpatient placement, more mental health care. In our agency, we are doing some small therapy groups again, which I'm super excited to have. We really revamped much of our interior here, not only making it more trauma-informed, but making it a space where we can be more COVID-friendly and COVID-safe. Our therapeutic group room right now, which is fairly large, has a large oval of nice-sized chairs, and every other chair is blocked off, creating a lot of space in between. So we have groups right now of up to 5 people, which is better than no people. And I just love being able to work with people face-to-face again when it's appropriate. So again, we certainly provide lots of telehealth options and can do face-to-face when that's the right fit. We do, of course, relapse prevention groups. We'll run seeking safety groups. When we are able to do treatment as usual with everybody in groups, we always have gender-specific groups. So we'll do a seeking safety for men and one for women, a relapse prevention group for men and one for women. We run a healthy relationships group. We're running a mindfulness group. We also offer coping with anger and parenting skills. One of our powerful trauma therapies, and it's a great therapy for many things, but really developed through a trauma focus, is brain spotting. Brain spotting, that it is a powerful focused trauma therapy treatment that works by identifying, processing, and releasing core neurophysiological sources of emotion, body, pain, trauma, dissociation, and a variety of other challenging systems. Brain spotting works in that brain-body neurological process of that nervous system in a way that is less reliant on the frontal lobe, where talk therapy, of course, very beneficial in that cognitive behavioral therapy, but it sometimes struggles to get to the core of where trauma is stored in that emotion, body, pain regulator. Brain spotting is an incredibly powerful way to do that and doesn't even actually ask people to re-verbalize those traumas. If you guys haven't checked that out, there's a brainspotting.com website. There's some videos on there from the developer, David Grand. It is really an amazing therapy. We've had some tremendous success here using that. Single event traumas seem to process very well with it. People that have come in with PTSD diagnosis and use brain spotting have actually left post-treatment not meeting criteria anymore for PTSD at follow-up 6 months later. So it's clearly, this is an exciting therapeutic process. And we have a case manager here who is funded to help provide personalized care that can support connection to services and agencies throughout our community and our state. If we do an assessment and somebody meets a level of care that we don't offer or needs it to access that somewhere else, she will work with people to get that paperwork in and get it done and make sure it gets there, and just to walk through all those difficult barriers that can happen for treatment. She'll access grant funding for people and give specialized care for people who choose medication-assisted treatment to help connect with a doctor if they're not already, or to make sure that they're connecting with those services or other treatment agencies if ours is not the right fit, that that also agree with the MAT treatment support. We of course also agree with that and are happy to provide services, substance use services for people in MAT. We have a couple of locations. This contact here is for our Kenai location. Our Homer number is the 235-8001. We have people down in that office 3 days a week, but we're seeing people that come there, we're providing telehealth. Unless they need something different, then we provide those services there. And looking forward to connecting a little better down there. I really wanna get some full-time clinicians in that Homer office, and I'm looking for that right fit, that right person that can be there. Yeah, and I appreciate the opportunity to get this information out there.
Thank you, Charlie. And I think it'll probably take all of us to try to remember to not call it Cicada anymore. So Cook Inlet Counseling, I love the name. Next up, Sea Sparrow Counseling. So Irene, I am going to hand it over to you.
Thank you. There's two of us right now, and me, and I am a MSW, and then Kim Glassbell is my co-partner, and she's an LCSW. We do counseling services, we do groups, and then we also have a separate arm where we do consulting. We do the major mood disorders, suicidal ideation and self-harm. We work with eating disorders. And then we also do LGBTQIA2+ identities, alternative relationship identities, kink, and then working with Full Spectrum to help with HRT treatment, gender affirming care, and all of those lovely things that all go together. And then we do work with substance misuse and then parenting support. So those parents that have the kiddos that are struggling, we work with them as well. We are doing telehealth right now, but we just started doing in person, which is great. So we have a COVID screening that people can do. And if they're vaccinated, we have an option for them to check a box for that. And then we can have a conversation about if they want to wear masks or not. So we're trying to be pretty open with that. And then we also offer phone counseling for established clients. We have a lot of clients actually who like to go for walks and then do their therapy on the phone, which is actually really cool. So we plan to do groups. We have two of them that we have started and planned, but we have not quite gotten off the ground yet. We have Straight Off the Couch, which is for the teens that experience anxiety, depression, major mood disorders, and also substance misuse. And then we have a parenting support group also that we're hoping to start pretty soon. Oh, and then we are going to do an LGBTQIA2+ group as well. So the consulting that we do, because Kim and I have so much experience in residential care, we can help parents navigate that residential care setting. So if they have kids that are going into or in the hospital for suicidal ideation or self-harm, and they need to look for residential facilities, we will facilitate that. And we also do training for culturally responsive training. So LGBTQIA, self-harm and suicidal ideation, and then depression, anxiety management. We work with medication management providers, not only with Full Spectrum Health, who comes down in person once a month, but we also work with Cloudberry Care Clinic out of Anchorage, and we coordinate a lot of stuff with them for meetings and then helping the clients access medications. And then each service, their insurance will cover it, we have been able to do that. If not, we have a fee-based service chart as well. And then we also do a sliding scale cash pay starting at $85 an hour. Clients can fill out financial information to qualify for that. We like to be affordable. We're social workers, so we think that all care should be equitable. And we're also applying for trying to find funding to help underprivileged or find people with financial difficulties be able to afford care as well, or just waive their fees. We are right across the street from the hospital right now, kind of kitty-cornered in the multi-space building, right across from Prodigy Medical and Dr. Marley. If anybody wants to stop by and say, hey, you can just text or call and come by and check us out.
I had no idea you did so much. So this was an awesome presentation. Thank you so much. Okay, so next up on our lineup, we have peer support folks with Nanilchik. So Zoe, I am going to pass it on to you.
Peer support, what is it? In general, it's when two people with the same types of life experiences come together to provide knowledge, experience, social, emotional, or practical help to each other. Peer support has actually been around for a while. According to the research that I could find, you know, 1600s, you know, the Quakers were struggling with despair and they had peers for each other. Shamans, they had peers for each other. AA and NA are two really great examples of peers being there for each other. People with common backgrounds coming together to relate to each other, really. It's all about connection. So what exactly does a peer recovery support specialist do? Well, we can facilitate peer support groups, activities, workshops. And one thing that's kind of unique about peer support, which is different from most people in healthcare, is we share our own personal life experiences. We also act as role models of recovery. And we can also provide case management, emotional support, crisis support, trauma-informed care. We can act as a liaison between medical and behavioral health staff. We hold space for clients free of judgment or bias. And obviously that's a lot easier said than in practice. You can also educate clients, educate the public with outreach and education panels like this one. You can assist clients in skill building. And one of the cool things about peer support is we come up with a case plan for our clients and we help them reach their goals. Their goals and everything is personalized. They tell us what they want and we just help them achieve it. We do not act as a counselor. We do not manage medication. We do not work solely in an office setting. We do not diagnose clients. We do not tell clients what they need to do. And we do not judge their story because everyone has a unique story. So for instance, specifics, like we can facilitate groups and just a couple different groups that I personally have been trained to facilitate is WHAM and it's Whole Health Action Management. Essentially, it's a multi-week group where people have a big goal. We break it down into manageable, digestible goals and help them work on it week by week by week. When we check in a weekly session, there's also SMART Recovery. SMART Recovery is kind of a newer alternative recovery support group. And it's a little different than the NAAA, but they do go through kind of a step process and work on handouts with each other in the meeting. And then Creation Station is kind of my baby. With COVID, I was trying to think, how can I reach out to people at home from a peer support standpoint to where I'm helping them with something that they might or have expressed wanting help with, but do it safely. And so I came up with Creation Station. And in a nutshell, what that is we ordered a bunch of craft supplies and they'll be able to check them out at their appointments. And it's just basic kind of craft skills. The more clients I talk to, I'm finding a lot of people just don't have hobbies, whether it be because they didn't experience really any hobbies or anything, or they've just been stuck in that cycle of, you know, finding money to purchase things, to use things, and they've just been stuck in that cycle. So they haven't had time for hobbies. We also do case management and we have to do clinical documentation with our clients. The case plans that we do with our clients, we kind of try to cover, you know, all the bases. And we try to, you know, talk to them, what are your goals about substance use? What are your goals about psychiatric? What are your goals about therapy? Do you want to see a counselor? Do you want to continue on that medication? Do you need help finding housing? Do you need help finding employment? Do you need job training? Do you need help going back to, so we kind of cover all the bases and I listed them on there, social, recreational, legal, family, parenting, hygiene, nutritional, transportation. Then we review it every 90 days, kind of see where they're at and then go from there. And again, all of this is self-directed by the client. And they're all their goals are in their own words. And we also abide by strict confidentiality, just like anybody else in healthcare. And we are HIPAA compliant. We act as mandated reporter if needed. We are trained in first aid, CPR, trauma-informed care, crisis intervention. But peer supports are unique in the sense that we're a boots on the ground approach. We don't have, you know, we don't have to have our clients come see us in an office setting or, you know, in a medical setting or anything like that. We can literally meet them where they're at, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, in whatever stage of their recovery. If I were to meet somebody and they were to say, oh, you know, I'm actively using, I use today, that it's not my place, you know, to judge that or have really any reaction to that. Just from there, I help them with where they want to be, where they want to go to, where they want to move to next. If they want to think about recovery, or if they maybe need help, you know, connecting with the exchange program or things like that. So I can do home visits with my clients, meet outside the office. I bring mobile supports and internet to people that don't have it. So that way they can complete like online filing for their PFD, things like that. One of my favorite things that I got to do in this position is I actually helped somebody take their driving test. Since COVID, you have to kind of bring your own driving instructor. And I got to do that. They set up a GoPro in the car and you go along with them and do all the things. We can also attend court, other goal-oriented functions with patients as long as it's on their case plan. And so peer support is seen as an evidence-based practice. And peer support is becoming, you know, nationally kind of accepted in every single state. There are a couple states that don't have state accreditation for peer supports, but I do believe they are in the process of working on that. And there is also the national route as well. And multiple studies have shown that providers were better able to achieve the following after implementation of peer supports. And they've been shown to better empathize and show compassion, access beneficial social services, respond directly to a client's strengths and desires, and to be tolerant, flexible, patient, persistent. And any questions or comments?
Awesome, Zoe. Hey, thank you so much for presenting. So next we have, we'll bring up back up Dr. Spencer, and she can share a bit more about her particular MAT program at Nanilchik.
Okay, so I just want to talk just briefly about low threshold care. So, you know, at our clinic, at NTC Clinic, we provide medications for addiction treatment for opioid use disorder and for alcohol use disorder. And we also support people with stimulant use disorders. There are medications that can be helpful for them, although there are no medications approved to treat stimulant use disorder. One of the care tracks in our program is low threshold care track. And so I just want to talk a little bit more about how we've added that to our program in the last couple of years, and specifically targeted towards patients who have two substance use disorders. They have an opioid use disorder and they have a stimulant use disorder together. So we kind of looked at our data in our clinic, and we have found that over the last 4 years, we've seen an increase in patients who have both problems. Previously, 23% of our patients seeking treatment for OUD also were using methamphetamines, and now it's about 35 or 36% of our patients presenting using opioids, typically heroin, but they're also using methamphetamine with that. And traditionally, patients, if you look at studies on patients who need to get treatment for their opioid use disorder, and we know, the standard of care is to get them on medications for addiction treatment. Unfortunately, patients who use methamphetamines as well historically have a very poor redemption treatment. It's hard to get them to come to their appointments. It's hard, get them to stay on their medication. And there's been a lot of reasons in the past that that treatment hasn't been accessible for these patients, and it hasn't really been designed in a way to fit the needs of this group of patients. In our program that offers harm reduction, low threshold based care, we, accept these patients who have really severe drug use disorders, and they may not be fully motivated for abstinence. So they may be motivated for abstinence from opioids, but not from amphetamines or not from alcohol. And so we work with their goals to develop a care plan to help them meet those goals, and then go from there as they proceed through their process. So we really try to make it as easy as possible for people to come in. So we generally can get people in on the same day or for walk-in appointments, in some cases, they're willing to wait. And that's been really critical because people who have really severe substance use disorders have a really hard time. Like one of the ways you define that is like they can't meet their obligations, right? That's part of the symptom of the disease. So you have to be sort of, flexible to help people to get in to see them when they're able to come in as much as possible. We can't always do it, but and we try to offer behavioral health services for these patients at the same time and day that they have their medical appointment. So they come in and see me, and then they also can see the behavioral health aid provider, counselor, if they're interested in doing that, or also have that available by telemedicine. Even if patients aren't willing to go see a counselor, we do a lot of, Annette and I do a lot of motivational interviewing with patients to try to help them set goals and get motivation to reach those goals. So we just talked about our peer support and how we help to get them transportation. So we'll go and pick them up and bring them to their appointment if they don't have a ride. Really help them to, and they, all those things she talked about is, you know, like helping them fill out applications and things. We have two choices for prescriptions for these patients. So we can either do really short prescriptions because these patients who have really chaotic lives, and some of them are homeless and they're using a lot of other drugs, we worry about things like diversion of medication. So we can give them short prescriptions with frequent appointments, and we can do video monitoring over the phone of their medications to make sure they're taking their medications. Or the other option is monthly injectable medications, which is a lot easier for these patients to adhere to in the long term. And I'll show you what we found with that with our numbers. We're just starting to offer some contingency management, which is the best treatment for stimulant use disorder. So we're working on developing that more, but to provide rewards and incentives for patients when they meet their goals, like having not using meth for the last week, you know, that sort of thing. And we offer Hep C treatment even for people who are still using drugs. And we make sure that people who are still using IV drugs have access to clean injection supplies. So we volunteer, a lot of us volunteer with the exchange, but also we partner with ANTHC, you know, through the Native Alaska Native Hospital System. They have a harm reduction program. So they will send us harm reduction supplies, like clean injection supplies, like kits that we can hand out to patients if they're not able to get to the exchange. You know, they tell us that they're still using like IV methamphetamine, even though they're not using heroin anymore. We want to keep them safe. So we kind of address all of their health needs. And what we found is that by adding in these extra services in the last few years, when we look at the retention and treatment, so this is how many weeks a patient took buprenorphine for. So before we made those changes, our patients were only taking buprenorphine. This subgroup of patients was only taking buprenorphine for about 9 weeks, so only about 2 months. And that increased to almost 23 weeks on average after we added these services. And for the subcategory of patients even within that low threshold group of patients, the last 2 years are patients. When we compare people that take the daily medication to the people who get the once a month shot, we see a pretty dramatic increased retention treatment. So it went all the way up to more than 6 months being able to keep them in treatment. So, and again, medication is going to protect them from overdose death. And because that combination is so deadly, the opioids, heroin, and methamphetamine is an incredibly deadly combination and is part of what's causing the huge rise recently in overdose deaths. So we need to keep people alive, and buprenorphine is going to help to protect them from overdose. And then also we saw with people who utilize peer support, they stayed in treatment for 12 weeks longer. So, you know, that's really quite an increase. So Sublocade is a brand name of extended release monthly buprenorphine injections. And so these monthly injections have to be administered in the medical clinic. Some advantages that they have is that there's no risk of diversion or abuse with it, again, because it's administered in the clinic once a month. It's the highest dose of buprenorphine of any of the forms, so it gives a really good blockade of other opioids like fentanyl. It has a flexible dosing. People can get their shot anywhere between the 4 to 6 week period, which makes it really nice again for people that might have trouble, you know, making their appointments and not have to worry about running out of medication and experiencing withdrawal. It's covered by Medicaid and most other insurances. It has a in the pharmacy company who made this did this trial that showed that 75% of patients who got were on it for a year remained abstinent a year after the study ended. So that's looking 2 years out. So good long-term data there. And other studies, not by the company, have shown that at between the 6 and 12 month marks, it has a very high patient satisfaction. So, in most of the studies, like over 70% of patients' medication satisfaction. And we found that in our practice too. I'd say about 3 out of 4 people really like it and want to stay on it once they start it. Not everyone loves it and a lot of people are apprehensive about making the switch, from daily buprenorphine dosing, but most people end up liking it once they start. So some advantages, we don't have to worry about monitoring the compliance with the medication. The only thing we need to worry about is getting people to come into their appointment. And sometimes it takes us weeks and weeks and weeks. And that's, part of Annette's job. And Zoe might help with that, trying to contact patients and get them to come in for their shot. We don't have to worry so much. We don't have to worry about counting medications. We still do urine drug screens. It's to guide our therapeutic conversation about what's going on in their lives. But it's not, they're not punitive. Drug screens never should be, we always tell patients you could always get your injection. It doesn't matter what else is going on in your life. I don't care how many drugs are in your urine drug screen. It doesn't matter. You can always get your sublocade injection. And that engages them and it keeps them engaged. And every month, they come in, even if the only one time they're engaged with us, at least it's that one time a month and we can sit down with them. We can see what they need and we can help them set goals. And it's a lot easier for some people when they're remote, it can be easier because they don't have to deal with mailing prescriptions and getting prescriptions lost, having frequent prescription refills. The people who benefit the most, from this, because this is a really expensive medication. I mean, yes, Medicaid pays for it, but it's like 2 to 3 times the cost of the regular buprenorphine. But patients, who have done well on buprenorphine in the past, but they've struggled with medication compliance. They just can't stick with taking it every day. They'll take a few days and stop and on and off. But they know that the buprenorphine helps them. So this can be great for them, those people. People who have overdosed previously or who are at high risk of overdose, again, this provides the highest level of buprenorphine, which helps to reduce risk of overdose. Other people that would benefit is people who do remote work. So we have people, our fishermen, who go out for 2 to 3 months at a time, and they can't take enough medication with them. We can only legally dispense 1 month of medication, and then they have no access to medication. So they either need to take less than they normally need, or they run out, or they go through withdrawal in the boat. If they don't take medication, they come back off medication. There's a high risk of overdose when they get back in town. So the nice thing about Sublocade is that we can load it up with a very high dose, and it will actually last them their entire 2 to 3 months out fishing. Things that patients have said about it, it works great. Anyone that says it doesn't is full of baloney. And I've had more than one patient say that's me, which I think is just hilarious. I had a number of patients also say, I love that I just wake up every day feeling normal. Like they don't have to worry about, I can tell my buprenorphine, I need to take my next dose because I'm starting to feel bad. I have to take that medication. They just feel the same every day. They just wake up feeling normal and people really love that. People who have been incarcerated before really like the fact that, they don't have to go through withdrawal because unfortunately in our criminal justice system, patients aren't always allowed to continue on their buprenorphine. And that can be horribly painful withdrawal and that can really make people not want to be on treatment. And so this allows people, they're not going to go through withdrawal and they're in jail, even if they're in incarceration for a long time, it just slowly wears off and there's no real withdrawal symptoms with stopping it. So, it really is pretty effective. And most patients who say everyone tries, something to see if it's going to work, try to use heroin and it's a very good blockade. So I think that's it.
Awesome. Thanks, Sarah and Zoe, for putting that together. Next up, we have Jay from South Peninsula Behavioral Health Center, the center.
Hi, I'm Jay, South Peninsula Behavioral Health. What we do is all the emotional and psychological support that goes along with your recovery process. So we don't do any of the medication-assisted treatment. We do the other side of it. We are working right now closely with Benita at Home Medical. So if you are in treatment there, you have a get into treatment quick card. You can knock on our door and we'll slide you through. We will do that for anyone that walks in off the street, by the way. If you come in and say that you are struggling with a substance use problem and you want to get help, we will get you into services as soon as the next group is available. Eventually, you'll have to do some of that paperwork, but we'll try and get you in to that, the, whatever the next service is that day or that week. We take all insurance, Medicaid, Medicare, and we take cash too. We have a sliding scale that goes to zero. So if you can't pay, don't let that be a problem. Come see us and we'll try and get you the help you need. But in essence, we're the psychological and emotional support for people trying to maintain recovery. So that's in a nutshell what we do. Thanks, Stephanie.
All right. Next, we have Willie with, he's going to talk about some of the 12-step programs in our community.
Great. Thanks, Stephanie. Good to see everybody. I became involved with the Opioid Task Force and some of the committees as a member of the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly. But I am also a person in long-term recovery, which for me means that I haven't had any alcohol or illicit drugs for the past 26 years. And that's been a wonderful way of life. It's I'm always happy to share my experience with recovery. So I noticed that a number of presenters already discussed or mentioned 12-step groups and references to 12-step groups. And Zoe talked about the one of the original peer support groups. There are dozens and dozens of types of 12-step groups. But they're all based on the original 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that was first published in 1939 in the book titled Alcoholics Anonymous. typically the only difference in other non-alcohol 12-step groups is the wording in the first step, which is we admitted we were powerless over and insert whatever word there. And that our lives had become unmanageable. So it's a suggested program of recovery for people who want it. 12-step groups typically don't provide an initial motivation for recovery, but it is a very powerful option for people. Locally in the Homer and the Southern Kenai Peninsula, there's a number of different 12-step groups available. There's Al-Anon, which is for friends and family of alcoholics. There's Overeaters Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Codependents Anonymous, and of course, Alcoholics Anonymous. The AA meetings in the Homer area happen 365 days a year. Every day of the year, there's a meeting, at least one meeting. Many days there are two or even three meetings per day available for Alcoholics Anonymous. And then also meetings in the Anchor Point in the Nilchik area. So it's widely available to whoever wants it. Some of them are online only. Some of them are in person, starting to move back to in-person meetings, and some of them are hybrid meetings where they're in person with an online component also. And they've been happening, the AA meetings in Homer, since the 1970s. So long history of 12-step support groups here in Homer. You know, as I mentioned, it is a peer support group, and it's absolutely free, no charge. Some meetings do collect donations to help pay the rent, but there's no fee, no entrance, no applications. Anybody who wants to can show up. Also, people often who are interested but might not be alcoholics or addicts or have a problem themselves, so just can stop in to see what the meetings are about, to maybe to learn more about it for a friend or a family member. They are non-religious, although there's lots of reference to spirituality and the word God is used in the 12 steps, but it's open to all beliefs or no beliefs. We have quite a few agnostic and atheists that participate in 12-step groups. And as I said earlier, it's suggested. There's no requirements, nothing mandatory about it. 12 steps, the book Alcoholics Anonymous, that where the 12 steps originated, recognized the disease concept of alcoholism quite a long time ago, and the necessity for abstinence. But I really liked what Charlie had to say, that you know, abstinence is one aspect, but connection is really important. And 12-step groups provide a tremendous opportunity for connection among people in recovery. There's no formal structure, and any two or three people that have an interest in recovery can form their own 12-step group and just start helping each other. In the Homer area, it's aahomer.org. I'll give you a list of all the AA meetings in Homer. It's a fantastic program, free of charge, and millions of people worldwide utilize it for recovery. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Next up is Annette. She is going to be sharing information about harm reduction.
Hi, everybody. My name's Annette, and I kind of have a few different roles in our community. I do work with Dr. Spencer at the MAT clinic for Nanilchik, and I also am a volunteer and a board member at the Homer Syringe Exchange. And I also do technical assistance work with other syringe service programs nationally and tribally. And I'm the only one that facilitates the tribal call. So the exchange is on the first and the third Tuesday of every month from 5 to 7 p.m. at the South Peninsula Training Room on the backside. We have really expanded in the last 2 years. Before COVID, during COVID, and still, we had our first annual board meeting last Saturday with an awesome turnout. And so some things that we're doing, we have people who work at other agencies, health clinics, mental health clinics, public health, who come and volunteer at the local syringe exchange, which has been an awesome opportunity for our participants to get some of their healthcare needs met when they're coming to the exchange, because they don't typically access healthcare services in the community. So we've partnered with some agencies to come provide Hep C testing, and people have been able to get tested and treated through the exchange. I am a volunteer. Dr. Spencer's a volunteer at the Homer Syringe Exchange. So our participants have that capability to connect with MAT providers in the community. We had found that there was like a stigma in that community around treatment services and MAT services. So we kind of started talking with those guys about what MAT is. And through those conversations, we've been able to, in the last 2 years, we've gotten 10 people who were coming to the exchange, being able to get them into treatment. And they're still in treatment 2 years later. Another great thing that happens at the exchange is being able to connect with people. So if somebody in the community, in the active using community, gets arrested and ends up at Wildwood pretrial, they have a contact source to help them, you know, transition out, because they don't want to go back to jail. So they are willing to get into some kind of treatment services, or they notify us about what's going on. We have a peer distribution model, we've been able to increase the amount of people that we access to the exchange. A lot of people didn't know about it. So we have some peer support people who will come and pick up and dispense around with their friends. And then secondary distribution is not a peer distributor, but it is somebody who supplies can be accessed if somebody misses the exchange and can't make it. We have a listserv of people that we, you know, text to remind them about the exchange, because we found that people weren't coming because they didn't know about it. So building that connection with people, it's personalized to the exchange. It's a very friendly place for people to come. It's a very safe place for people to come. They feel like they can engage in conversation with us. We can engage in conversation with them. It's been, I think, something that's been extremely important in the last 6 months is the conversations around drug supply in the community. And we've been able to prevent multiple overdoses. People can come to us and say, oh, I overdosed last week or yesterday, or I've revived somebody from an overdose this last week. So being able to have kind of that connection with people when they're ready to accept treatment or just get kits and supplies, we've learned a lot of things through there. And right now we're back open. We can have one person in at a time. We're revamping our data collection, the questions that we ask, things that are more pertinent to, you know, our community and what we're looking for. So we're really excited about the next year, where we have an awesome vision. It's going to get us aligned in other ways with other syringe service programs around North America.